Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Professor Tariq Ramadan, Oxford University and President of the European Muslim Network, ladies and gentlemen, assalamu alaikum. May the peace of God and His blessings be upon you all. I must begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which we stand. And allow me to say that this is the first international symposium to be held by the Griffith University Islamic Research Unit, or GIRU for short. GIRU, we want GIRU to become the guru of Islamic studies.
Welcome to Encounter on ABC Radio National. I'm Florence Sperling. We're at this international symposium held in Brisbane last week, The Challenges and Opportunities of Islam in the West, The Case of Australia. The keynote speaker was the European Muslim scholar Tariq Ramadan. The conference was attended by Muslim scholars, students and community leaders from Australia and overseas. Present also were Australian politicians, Christian theologians, leaders in various government agencies, lawyers and academics. The conference and this encounter opened with Dr. Mohammed Abdullah from Griffith University's Islamic Research Unit. The conference was sponsored by the Queensland Government, Griffith University and the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils. The 3 days were about engaging constructively with Muslim scholars and communities. Professor Tariq Ramadan is an advisor to the British Government and Scotland Yard. Last year he also advised the Australian Government. This program, which is called Tariq Ramadan, is an edited recording of his lecture at the conference. He was introduced by Professor Charles Samford.
It's my job as moderator to introduce Professor Tariq Ramadan. He is president of the European Muslim Network in Brussels. He holds MAs in philosophy and French literature and PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies from the University of Geneva. In Cairo, he's had one-to-one intensive training in Islamic scholarship at Al-Azhar University, and emphasising the great tradition of learning that is represented by Islamic study and Islamic science. He's written or co-authored 20 books, 700 articles, and he's contributed substantially to debate on the issues of Muslims in the West and Islamic revival in the Muslim world. He's currently Senior Research Fellow at St Anthony's College, Oxford, and the Lakahi Foundation, London, and he's also President of the European think tank European Muslim Network in Brussels.
Tariq Ramadan is described by some as a controversial figure, often evoking a hostile press, as occurred here last week. His grandfather founded the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and Tariq Ramadan himself has been accused of saying one thing to his Muslim followers and another to his Western audiences, an accusation he denies. He acknowledges that he does not represent all Muslims.
I'm used to say when I begin a lecture to identify myself by saying, look, first, remember, I'm not representing all the Muslims because there are trends. So you're helping me to say this. I'm from the reformist trend, which is saying something which is simple. I want to be faithful to the Islamic principles, but to take into account the context and the situation, the environment within which I live. And I would say that if you look at the Muslims throughout the world, and even in this country, it's the mainstream. The mainstream are reformist. Now, that's true, that you have people. And you know, the six categories are not closed categories. You know, the mystics can be also reformist, or they can be literalists, it depends, or traditionalists. So what I'm always saying to the people, you know, Islamic universal reference is as complex as the Christian one. And you show respect to the people when you accept from the beginning that they are as complex as you are. So I think that, yes, you have literalists. You have people in this country saying, we don't have to mix. This is not our country. You have literalists, and you have also traditionalists. That's fine. The problem is for us to have this intra-community dialogue, to accept the different trends. But you should know that the mainstream is for the Muslims to be at the same time faithful to the principles and at the same time facing the challenges of our world. So I hope that it's clear for you, the reformist trend is, but not the rationalist reformist. The reformist meaning that you can use the Salafi reformist that as I'm using it in the text. I'm not saying it when I'm talking like this because in the text I'm explaining what is the meaning of Salafi. Salafi is to come back to the first generations of the companions and the second and third generation. the people who were close to the Prophet, peace be upon him, and trying to be faithful to the principles. So Salafi in the sense of trying to be faithful to the principles and also the creativity of the first companions, because they were very creative in the way they were dealing. So you have different Salafi. And this is why today we speak about the Salafi as Wahhabism. And I say we have to be cautious, because Salafi cannot be just colonized by this group by saying this is Salafi, they are the closest. I think that here there is something which has to do with definition. For example, this book, which was written by this woman in France, is using this saying. You know what? He himself is saying about himself that he's a Salafi, meaning close to Bin Laden, by not defining the word as I am doing it in the book. So I'm trying to be very clear on being faithful to the principles. So it's a Salafi reformism, faithful to the principles, open to the change of time and geography.
Our Encounter website will carry shortly a thoughtful exchange between Professor Ramadan and a member of the audience about further definitions of reformist trends in Islam. What is possibly most controversial about Tariq Ramadan is that he was barred from entering the United States in 2004 as he was about to take up an academic position there. He tackled this issue immediately in his lecture.
I am obliged, being here and having been invited in this country, to say two words about some of the articles that were published during the last 2 days, repeating things that are simply unacceptable. Unacceptable asking the government to follow in the footsteps of the American policy when the American government is really doing wrong. Two things that I wanted to say. The first is, yes, so far I am banned from the States. I got the visa in 2004, and this was banned 9 days before I was to go for a double tenure position at Notre Dame University. I was asking for 2 years with ACLU, and the American Association of University Professors, and the American Academy of Religions, plus 18 universities. We want to know why. And we got no answer till last September. Last September, we got an answer. And this answer is as follows, because I was asked when I went for the interview, and the interview was 80% of the questions were about my position on Iraq and Palestine. It has nothing to do with terrorism. By the way, afterward, they withdrew. They withdrew everything which has to do with terrorism, and they just were saying, we will come with an answer, and they came. I was asked if I gave money for some organizations, and I said yes, 12 organizations. Among them, there is one organization. And they said, afterward, 2 years, you should have known that this organization was connected to Hamas. The point is that this organization is today officially recognized in Europe. It's not blacklisted. But the most important point is that I gave this money between 1998 and 2002. 1 year before this organization was blacklisted in the States. I should then reasonably have known 1 year before the Homeland Security that this organization was to be blacklisted 1 year later. You laugh, and this is why I cannot go. But in fact, it's not for that. It's because, as I was told clearly, that my stance on Iraq, saying what you are doing there is illegal, and I am not, I will never support what you are doing in Iraq, and I'm critical towards the unilateral support of Israel against the rights of the Palestinians. I said it, I repeat it, and it's your honor today to welcome me here when you don't accept to be banned from a country in the name of freedom of speech. And the point for me, and I said it, I will never confuse between the Americans and their current government, because I really admire all these people, all these American professors, teachers, organizations, people supporting and saying no to this government. And as I said, to be banned from the current Bush administration is much more a honor than a dishonor for me. Criticizing governments when they are doing wrong is the dignity of the human beings. It's the dignity.
Professor Tariq Ramadan, taking his audience now to the centre of his thinking about Islam in Europe.
The Muslim presence in the West is not a new presence. the Muslim presence in the Western country, in Australia, in Europe, is a very long presence. And even on the philosophical, on the religious ground, the contribution of Muslims to the construction of the European Western mind is something which is quite clear. So there is something here which is really important. We should never forget this history. Because this history is also revealing something. Our selected approach towards our own history, the West, is nurturing something which is always to repeat that Islam is as if we are talking about an alien religion coming from completely new to our intellectual framework. I think it's completely wrong. But now we also have to distinguish between this very old presence and a new presence, a new visibility after the Second World War and even for you more recently in the 70s. What we have to do is also to be able to build a common history of memories and being able to be inclusive in our common history. And this is, for example, you know, when you listen to the Pope saying the only two roots of Europe are Christianity and the Greek tradition, is worrying because it's wrong. It's simply wrong. It's not true. And then he is reducing the past because he's scared of the present and the Muslim presence. And we have to come together to say, no, in fact, Islam is as part of the West as today the West is part of the Islamic, you know, thinkers. And it's, you know, a mutual collaboration, and we are taking and giving, and it's the same on all the sides of the spectrum here.
We're at an international symposium held in Brisbane last week called The Challenges and Opportunities of Islam in the West, The Case of Australia. The keynote speaker is Tariq Ramadan, president of the European Muslim Network based in Brussels. He's currently senior research fellow at St Anthony's College, Oxford. The conference was hosted by the Key Centre for Ethics, Law, Justice and Governance at Griffith University's Islamic Research Unit. We return to Tariq Ramadan's lecture and the importance of scriptural sources in Islam.
The second thing which I wanted to raise is, with our presence in the West, we are facing theoretical challenges that have to do with religious concerns, the way we are reading the scriptural sources, how to be a Muslim, how do we read the scriptural sources, the Quran and the prophetic traditions, how do we redefine some of the concepts that we are using, how do we have to deal with the context, the new context, and then because we have a new context, to come back to the sources and to be able to look at the sources in the way these scriptural sources were connected to a specific context. So it's a double dialectical process. Us and the context, coming back to the scriptural sources and the context, to be able to extract from the scriptural sources the principles and to come to the principles with the new to the new context. Not easy. It's not easy, but it's essential. This has to do with academic work. It's not only to do with, you know, people coming and say, I'm going to tell you the truth about Islam. And this is where we need our collaborators, professors and teachers, to be able also to understand that we are speaking about something which is quite complex and needs specialists, professors, academia. This is why what you are doing by promoting, you know, a center for excellence, this is exactly what we need. We need it at that level. You know, amateurism and things like this at that level, it cannot work. So if we want to be serious with the Muslim community or the Muslim communities in the West, we should come to the theoretical challenges with a sense of responsibility. We are dealing with complex issues. But also we are dealing with practical challenges. And these practical challenges have to do with the daily life of the Muslims, men and women. They have to do with the way we are dealing with identity, loyalty. They have to do also with citizenship, the way we are committed and involved in social projects, politics. All these fields have to do with the practical challenges. And what we need, and I say it as an introduction, we need on the practical field more specialization, people being able to understand that when it comes to social issues, we need people knowing what we are talking about. When it comes to education, we need teachers and educationists. When it comes to imams and religious authority, we need to be specialized here. We need two things, specialization and institutionalization. We need institutions that are solid because they should represent the Muslim presence. So this is something which is quite important. Institutionalization of our presence is to stop just having organization trying to do everything at the same time. We go from academia to practical things to social works. I think that this was a phase. This is a step. We have to go further. And this is the challenge for all of us in the West. And a positive note of all this is that it's happening. It's happening. It's slow. It's a slow process. But this is the reality of everything which has to do with migration and immigration and settling down in countries. We need time and we need a collaboration from the surrounding society. So what we have to do is to come back to this and to be able to say, okay, in my own experience, what is cultural and what is religious? And then also to come to the scriptural sources, and here we need specialists to be, this is in the text, we can extract it in the way. It's immutable. For example, the five pillars of our practice is not cultural. You go from Africa to Indonesia, you will find the people doing exactly the same. We practice the same. This is why we are speaking about one Islam. There is one Islam, but many Islamic cultures, depending on the geography. And there are many readings, by the way. This is why we explain diversity. But the Arab culture is not the Asian culture. And now what we are experiencing is that in every single country, we will have something which is an Islamic Australian culture. And even in Europe, I'm speaking about a European Islamic culture, but it's not exactly right. If you go to Europe, you have to understand that the French Islamic culture is not the British Islamic culture. Put a French Muslim and a British Muslim and you will see the difference. They have something which is coming from their specific culture. The way they think about pluralism, the way we deal with religion is completely different. They are nurtured by their cultural environment. And this will be the future. So to be able to say to the people who are coming from Turkey, who are coming from Lebanon, who are coming from every majority Islamic country, anyone coming here, the first step is, yes, you are going to be protective. But the way forward is to be able to remain faithful to the principles, to leave what is cultural, and to integrate from the Australian culture everything which is not in contradiction with your principles. And in fact, you have to be inclusive on the cultural ground. So this is the theoretical challenge. Why? Because we really need to be able to say, no, it's much more cultural than religious. For example, many of the challenges when it comes to women. When it comes to women, you know, I have great, you know, respect for our scholars. But it's clear for me when you read Tabari, Al-Qurtubi, or when you read even Abu Hamid Al-Ghazali, they are saying things on women that are completely cultural. I would criticize them in the name of Islam because I can say in the name of the text, I can be critical in the way you are reading the text out of your culture. So it's a critical, positive construction here, which is in the name of the text, I'm criticizing the way you are reading the text through a cultural, you know, window or dress. This is something which needs to be done, and it's a first challenge, but it's not easy. All of us here, Muslims and non-Muslims here, we have to show respect to the people who are going through this experience. It's never, never, never easy to leave some roots and to build a new home. Any one of you who know the meaning of exile, you know, exile is not that you are only doing it physically. Exile is just to consider yourself in a new home here, it's my home, and just to go from the roots of the memory of my fathers and mothers, and then to come here. I went through this experience when I was very privileged, because I didn't went through the economic exile. It was a political exile, and still it was very difficult just to be able to say here. We need to have it done through a very strong theoretical framework where we are building the first dimension. And here we come to the second dimension, identity. It's really important to be able to build a positive identity. So we have, once again, you have two ways. It's to say, you have your Muslim identity, it's a closed identity, rely on it, and everything else is not you. So you have two ways to build your identity. It's an identity against the other, or it's an identity in the name of who you are and you're trying to build, in the name of some of the principles that are not cultural, but they could be religious, but open to everything which is cultural. And this is what I try to do When I was writing to be a European Muslim, I came to the Islamic identity and say, what are the principles that are beyond the cultural reality? And then at the end, we come with something which has to be very strong. Yes, you rely on some principles, and these principles, some of them, are immutable. For example, the six pillars of faith, when we speak about al-aqidah, this is not going to change. We believe in this. As believers, if you are a Muslim and you are a believer, you believe in these six principles. And then you have your practice. But this is only a dimension of your identity. Then you have to build a culture, cultural dress. So as you are living here, you should be able to look at everything which is in the Austrian culture, which is not in contradiction with your principles, and you take it. We have a saying coming from the prophetic tradition, Al-Hikmatu Dallatul Muslim. Wisdom is the last property of the Muslim, and he's the first to take it wherever he or she finds it. When it's good, it's mine. I'm putting it very simply. I talk to you. You have a good idea, it's mine. You have a bad idea, it's yours. That's it. No, you are laughing. It's simple, but it's very important. It changed the mindset. The mindset is completely different. You come in the country, you look at the culture. Okay, the people are drinking many, many drinks, and there is alcohol. So you say, alcohol, no, it's not for me, because it's prohibited by my religion. But anything else I can do, I will take. I integrate. Good taste, it's mine. Creativity, cultural creativity, literature is mine. Things that are not in agreement with my principles, I should have a selective mind. And by the way, it's really interesting to go through this experience. Because through this experience, you come back to your culture of origin, and sometimes you are critical because you understand that in the cultures of origin, not everything is good. And you also have to do this. If I am a contribution to all Australians here, it's by telling them, watch your culture. Not everything is good. Be critical. Be selective. There are things that you are nurturing, and there are things sometimes you have to be cautious. You know, sometimes we have to be more welcoming, more warm towards the people. I'm not saying that the Austrians are not. I'm saying that in every situation we have to address this. A critical approach towards our culture is what is helping us to be open-minded towards the people. So the point here is to be able to do this and then to come to one simple and difficult at the same time statement, which is, we don't have one identity. We have multiple identities. And then multiple identities and moving identity. It's changing. We don't have a static identity. This is and a closed identity. It's more than that. This is why, when I'm talking to Muslims at the grassroots level, coming from even the scriptural sources, a theoretical framework helping them to stay at the same time you are a Muslim, but you can be a Muslim by religion, an Australian by culture. You have a memory, don't lose your memory. Don't lose its richness. Anyone who is telling you to be a good Australian, forget everything about Turkey, forget everything about Lebanon, is wrong. Be connected to the richness of your past. It's a richness. And it's a contribution to the country. What is very interesting for Australia is to be inclusive in the common history of Australia, to have the richness of the memories of all the people who are building the country. So this is something which is really important, the memory. And then you have principles. It's part of your identity as well. And you can have, you know, countries of adoption. This is why, for example, I'm saying always and repeating this, but this should be built on something which is, it's not contradictory with the Muslim Islamic principles, in which way you are a Muslim and you have the cultural dress. And you come back to the prophetic experience and you see that he went from Mecca to Medina. And in Mecca, the same principles, but it was a culture. And then he was to Medina, and in Medina they were a different culture, with the women, for example, much more present in the social, the public sphere. And he accepted both. And it was a challenge for the Muslims to go from one culture, because they thought the only way to be a good Muslim is the way we were in Mecca. So Omar, who was a companion, came to the Prophet. He wasn't not happy with the way the women were acting and behaving. And the Prophet smiled. He accepted this way, because it's not against the principle. It's another way to be faithful to the principles. And you have to accept both ways. So this is something which is really important. And then, as I would say, you have a nationality also. It's part of your identity. So I'm a Swiss by nationality. I'm a Muslim by religion. I am a European by culture. I'm an Egyptian by memory. A universalist by principle. Welcome to the multiple dimension of my identity. But this is based on very deep, you know, study. And this is to be studied and widespread, then taught to the people in which way you can be both at the same time. There is no contradiction. But for this, from the theory to the practice, you need to deal with psychology and time. And this is sometimes the people don't understand this. To change the mentality, to let the people understand this is home for you, you have to work on that dimension, is so important. Loyalty, it's another dimension. Because the Muslims very often say, you belong to the Ummah. The Ummah is the international Muslim community. So the people are saying, okay, that's fine. You are Australian, or you are European, or you are American. What is your connection between being part of the Ummah and at the same time part of this nation? And as Muslims, we have to come back to the text. In which way am I connected to my community, which is first a spiritual community? It's a spiritual community based on principles. It's not a blind belonging to a community. I will support you, you are right. I will support you, you are wrong. No, it's a spiritual community based on principles. And this is why you come to the text and you build something which is very strong. Knowing that once the Prophet, peace be upon him, said to his companions, help your brother when he is right or wrong. Look at this. You know, by the way, one of the quotations here is coming from a woman who is saying, she cut the reference here. Say, look what he's saying. He's saying, help your brother when he's right or wrong. Cutting. Not saying the second part of it. And the second part is the essence of the whole thing. That one companion said, I know how to help my brother when he's right. How could I help him when he's wrong? Prevent him from doing wrong. Look at that. Your belonging, brotherhood means critical approach towards your own brother. You are right, I'm with you. You are wrong, I will prevent you from doing wrong. So it's not a blind support. So my belonging to my community is something which is critical. When the Muslims are right, I will support. But when, for example, they are going to kill people, innocent people in the States, or innocent people in Bali, or innocent people in London, I have, in the name of my religion, to say this is against Islam. It's not only non-Islamic, it's anti-Islamic. So I have to stand up and to say, no, this is my belonging to the spiritual community based on principles. And then I am a citizen. And then when I am a citizen, I have a tacit contract with my society, saying to all my fellow citizens, I abide by the law of the country. So these laws are my laws. This legislation is mine. So we have also to build here a very strong theoretical, you know, approach and framework, methodology, helping this to be understood in the right way. Your belonging to the Ummah is not undermining your loyalty to the country. Quite the opposite. You have to be loyal to the country, and the loyalty to the country means that the country is respecting two fundamental rights, freedom of conscience and freedom of worship. And this is the fact everywhere in the West. So we don't have a problem with the law. Then we had this discussion, and you know, in Afghanistan, just after September 11, some American soldiers were asking, Muslims were asking, should I go and should I say, no, I can't go because we are going to kill Muslims. You had some Muslim scholars in the world saying, you cannot go because you are going to kill Muslims. This was the reason. And others were saying, no, go just to show your loyalty to the country. And my answer was completely different based on studies. Once again, we belong to our principles. If in your soul, in your conscience, you think that it is right to go, you are a citizen in the country. You have also to ask yourself, is it right or is it wrong to go in a war? So the point is, even with your country, you belong to your principles. And this is why we are nurturing the fact that the best citizens in a society, in a democratic society, are not the people who are supporting blindly the government. They're the people who are critical. When the government is right, I'm supporting. If I think it's wrong, I'm saying it's wrong. This is where democracy lies. It's by having citizens being able to speak their mind. And I was saying this just after September 11th to the Muslims in the States. Be careful of this rhetoric coming from the current administration. You are with us or against us. Because in the name of your own fears, you are going to blindly support or to be quiet. No, the true, active, positive, contributing Muslims in the States and here in Australia are the people who know what the critical mind means. I'm supporting when it's right, and I'm critical. So if, at the end, you are involved in a war, and you really think, in the name of your conscience, that you cannot do it, there is something that we all know, it's something which has to do with conscientious objection. Sometimes it happens that you have to take this decision. I have a great respect for the Christians and the Muslims during the Vietnam War who said, I can't do that. I can go to kill the people. And now what we are saying about them, that we show respect to them. They were put in jail. So it's a personal decision at one point you have to decide. And, of course, you have to be committed to the legislation of the country. We have to stop talking about if the enemies are Muslims, you don't go. If they are non-Muslims, go and kill. This is un-Islamic. This is wrong. And you have to come to, you belong to your country, you have a tacit contract, and in some situation, ask your conscience. Are you ready? Yes or no? And by the way, I hope that every one of us is doing this in every single situation of his life or her life. Is it right or not? Because our silence sometimes is not dignified. It's not the right way to be in such a situation.
This is Encounter on ABC Radio National. We're at an international symposium in Brisbane called The Challenges and Opportunities of Islam in the West, The Case of Australia. We're listening to the keynote address by Muslim scholar Tariq Ramadan. He now extends his argument about the issue of belonging for Muslims in the West.
Just after July the 7th, I was involved in the task force in the UK with the government, and I was talking to the government, the Australian government, when we had this video conference. And look, when we are talking about integration, what do we mean? Mainly we mean social integration, cultural integration, intellectual integration. Social integration meaning you have jobs and you are in the society. Cultural integration, you are westernized or you know the surrounding culture. And intellectual integration, you have been educated, so there is something which is a sense of going through the whole dimension of what integration is in our mind at the social level. 95% of the people who were involved in the suicide bombings in the UK and in the States were having all these parameters and these conditions. Westernized they were, culturally integrated, intellectually. Some of them had PhDs, very well educated, no problem of education. They were not marginalized people. And then at the same time, so intellectually and socially integrated, they had job. What was missing? What was missing? Born and raised in some European countries or in Britain. You listen to the video of Mohammed Siddiq Khan and you understand where is the problem. He's telling his own fellow citizens, you are killing our brothers there. We are going to kill you here. It's a us versus them rhetoric. He doesn't feel that he belongs to the country. This is not my country. So he got all the parameters of what we call integration, except one, which is the psychological integration, to feel at home. And here we have a theoretical challenge. And in fact, it will come. A time will come here in your country where you will have to say what we are trying to say now in Europe. The true success of integration is to stop talking about integration. Because as long as we talk about integration, it's still an us versus them approach. Second, this is why I'm advocating a post-integration discourse, which is now we have to go beyond that. Of course, you are at the beginning of a process. You know, in France, in the UK, we are reaching now the fourth or fifth, you know, generation. And where lies the problem? After five generations, we still call them British citizens with an immigrant background. Wow. Four generations. So when do we start to lose that with an immigrant background? Because in Australia, you are much more than us, even in Europe. It's really a country of immigration. You are all immigrants. The only difference between not the indigenous and the people who are there, but the people who came after. The only difference is that we are older immigrants. It's a question of time. So we have to think about in which way we go beyond this. And here, it's a very important Muslim discourse on the belonging, you belong. So on the culture that we accept, on the rules that we respect, on the people that we live with, the pluralistic dimension of the society, and to be able to say, hadhihi ummati, meaning this is my ummah.
Then we come to education. Professor Tariq Ramadan.
Education, you know, I'm not promoting something which is a parallel system. I think that the future is to be together. I am coming from this system which is common, you know, following the state school system to be together. I learned a lot by being by non-Muslims. I think that I can understand that some, they are not happy with the state's, you know, official system, and they want something which is to protect their kids. I can understand this, but I think that this is and could just lead us towards self-segregation. We need to be together. But it means that we have a very strong supplementary system, which is what we are providing after school, on Sunday, on Saturday, and after school. And here, we need people to be a bit specialized. We need to be creative here. Some of our kids, they don't want to go. And every year, they are repeating the same thing. We are destroying ourselves, the teaching of Arabic, in the way we are dealing with it in the supplementary school, in many, many organizations, because it's very, you know, amateur. We are asking people, oh, you know Arabic? You are going to be the teacher in Arabic? I can know Arabic, but I cannot be a good teacher. It's not because I know the language that I know how to teach it. So the point here, we have to come with something which is an adapted. Some of our kids are going to schools during the week, and in the schools, they know how to ask questions, to be critical. They go to the mosque during the weekend, keep quiet, not a word. You have to listen. No critical mind within the religious community. This is completely wrong. So we have to reform our way of teaching according to the environment. And by the way, what we want is to do this in the Islamic majority country. We need more critical minds asking questions, which was exactly what the companions were doing with the Prophet, peace be upon him, asking questions. So we have to work on different fields, primary, secondary, what you are doing here, once again, university. We need, you know, spaces where we can teach, and the Muslims should be involved. There is suspicion. We have to know. We all know that. There is suspicion around the West that we think that the committed Muslims cannot be objective with his or her own religion. It's as if to teach Islam, you should be a non-Muslim to be objective. While when it comes to Christianity, to Judaism, to Buddhism, to feminism, to atheism, to Marxism, you can be from within, and we think that you can't be objective. I'm sorry. You can be completely, fully convinced Muslim and be objective with it, and this is what we want for the future. We want Muslims to be at the highest level of scholarship, to be able to be objective with the matter they are teaching, the discipline they are teaching, and at the same time to be respected by the within academia. This is the future. So education is central. And also for our societies, and this is what we have started to do in many countries, and I think that you have to think about it, it's institutionalizing in our countries here the training of imams.
This is Encounter on ABC Radio National. We're in Brisbane at an international symposium about Islam and the West, where the keynote speaker is Professor Tariq Ramadan, Senior Research Fellow at St Anthony's College, Oxford. Here now are a few of his concluding remarks.
For us, Islam is a solution, but not a solution to social... No, it's a solution because it gives peace to our heart. There is something which is a spiritual dimension. And sometimes we need to have this said to the Muslims within the community, to our fellow citizens in the society, this is part of us. So a spiritual discourse to be heard by our fellow Muslims, but also fellow citizens, is so important. It's missing. It's also missing the discourse on ethics. Ethics is something which is really important. Ethics of citizenship, ethics in politics, ethics in economy. And here, with this kind of discourse, we are coming with something which is universalist. Because when I'm sitting with non-Muslims and I'm speaking about ethics of consumption, ethics of citizenship, ethics in politics to try to be more transparent, to work against corruption, all these things, that we are sharing these things. But the absence of a discourse doesn't help us to get to these commonalities. And I think that it's a very important challenge, as also to the objectives. More than that, what I'm very often saying to the Muslims is, if you are serious about the own Islamic principles, you will find that we have, you know, the great scholars, and among them is Shatibi and others, were speaking about six principles of Islam. protecting, you know, the six major principles, protecting religion, protecting the intellect, protecting the progeny, protecting your wealth, protecting personal integrity or life, or dignity as well, the six principles. And you look at the situation in the West, and you say, in which countries these principles are the more protected? In the Islamic majority countries or in the West today? Very often, they are much more protected as principles and objectives in the non-Muslim countries in the West. In Australia, it's much more easy to have these protected than in many Muslim majority countries. So when you have this in mind, you try to build a more positive discourse on the fact that you look at not only what is missing in these countries, but you already have. And you have a narrative which is completely changing the mindset. This is an important challenge.
At the end of the lecture, I asked Professor Ramadan about how he would describe the process of Sharia.
Can you tell me about Sharia law? You talk about the importance of how it's actualized in context and how it's not only the expression of universal principles of Islam, but how you think through the actualization. Can you give me an example, hypothetically? You live in Europe, you speak about Muslims in Europe. How would a group of Muslims or an individual Muslim in Europe work through in their own mind something like the issue of the death penalty, which is banned, abolished, opposed in Europe and is a critical issue in the identity of the European Union? What would be the process of how a Muslim person in Europe might think about that as an issue compared to, say, for instance, in our own region here in Australia with Indonesia, where the death penalty is applied as part of the law of the state of Indonesia? Now, that's largely a Muslim community. Perhaps the context and the experience of thinking through the actualization of Sharia law might be different for an Indonesian Muslim than it might be for a European. Not because I'm suggesting Indonesia is using Sharia law officially, but because of the cultural setting, that contextual setting that's different.
Yes, but I think that it's really important here to come to a better understanding of the principles and the objectives. What do we want to achieve? And this is why, you know, for example, we heard this morning that Sharia is Islamic law. And I think that this translation and the definition of the specialist in law, so the jurists, my understanding, the way I'm translating it out of all the texts that we have, is that Sharia is the way towards faithfulness, is in which way we carry on throughout our history and depending on the geographical realities, we are trying to be faithful to the principles. So the laws should be read or implemented in the light of the way. And sometimes the way, which is showing you the purposes, pointing out the purposes, justice, equality, in the name of the way, you shouldn't implement or you have to suspend the very meaning of a literal verse because it's betraying the purposes. It could be unjust. So, for example, I'm going further than that as to us in the Western context by saying, when I'm dealing with the legislation of a country, and I know that the message and the purpose of the Islamic message is justice. And I have a law telling me, before law, all the citizens are equal and should be treated equally. I'm not saying, you know, this is the British law and this is the French law. I'm saying, look, in the name of the purposes of the Islamic message, this is my Sharia. It's the way it's implemented here. So, look, it's something which is really breaking something which has to do with a binary vision, which we have a Sharia system against the other. Is no, we have principles and objectives. When these principles and objectives are met and respected, whatever is the legal system, from wherever it comes, it is my Sharia, because this is what I want to implement. So it's much more powerful as to the sense of belonging, as to understand where you live. So, for example, I feel better in Britain today where I live because we are equal before law. Of course, there are discrepancies in the way this is implemented. So we have to struggle. It's an ongoing struggle to meet with the ideal of the text, that just to get at that level. But this discrepancy is not questioning the text per se or the articles of the laws and the common ground. So this is something which is really important here, is to be able to say this is much more me than, for example, the way people will never get citizenship in some petro-monarchies, and when you are Pakistani or Filipinos, you are going to be completely discriminated Well, there we are not respecting the objectives, while here we are. So where is Sharia, there or here? Much more here than there. So I think that this is really important, and it comes to the death penalty, where exactly the same positioning. I was in the States talking to the Muslims in the Islamic Convention there, and I told them if I was an American citizen, I would be the first to be against the death penalty in this country, because no conditions are respected. If you are an African-American, you are 5 times more likely to be killed than a white. It's just plain injustice. You cannot promote this. So don't say in the name of Islam, because you feel that Islam is promoting death penalty, that you cannot go for acting or struggling or striving against it. In fact, you are for justice. It's unjust. Stop it. And this should be the same here in Europe or in Australia, but also in Indonesia. Is it right the way they are treated? Is there a way for them to protect themselves? Do they have the lawyers? Is this a just system? If it's not, if the conditions are not there, the high condition just to be able to start thinking about implementing something like this, if we don't have these conditions, we have to stop straight away. So I would say that today, for me, to be a Muslim consistent with our values, you cannot support and promote death penalty. And this is where I think that this is my Sharia. So my thinking here is coming through the objectives and then the principles.
So it's not so much you're opposed to the death penalty in the abstraction, you're opposed to the death penalty in the way it doesn't take into account the disadvantage of, say, the African-American groups, who are mostly the people who the death penalty applies to. Is that what you mean, or do you mean in the abstraction you would be opposed to the death penalty?
No, we have a revelation, and in the book you have text speaking about, death penalty, in one way or another, killing someone. So I'm taking the text seriously. But what I'm also taking seriously is that from the beginning, this text is telling us that there are very high conditions. And to gather the condition is, for me, quite impossible to gather. So it's much more to tell us about the gravity of what could be done. This is like a deterrent process. But at the end of the day, I have to be consistent with the conditions, and this is why it's much more powerful for me to speak to myself and to Muslims by saying, look, the text is saying this, but it's putting clearly conditions. The conditions are not there, and as long as we don't have the conditions, there is something which is impossible to implement. And then, would it be possible to gather all these conditions? I don't know, and I think no. But still, as long as we don't have them, we have to stop this. We can work on the deterrent process of saying to the people, this is very grave and corruption and all this is something that we have to avoid. But without denying the very meaning of the text, but without diminishing, underestimating all the conditions that are here. And this discourse could be heard by the Muslim. But if just in abstraction, in the absolute, sitting here, say, I condemn this, it's not going to be heard, because this is why the Muslims are not acting against death penalty, because they really think that this is Islamic. They don't really think about the conditions that we have together to do that.
European Muslim scholar Professor Tariq Ramadan, and we leave this international symposium in Brisbane and refer you to abc.net.au/religion, where you can find audio streaming, podcast links, and during the coming week, a full transcript of the keynote address and questions from the floor, as well as a transcript of the program, which is called Tariq Ramadan. This is Encounter on ABC Radio National. Thanks to all who took part, and thanks to Kate Evans. Sound engineers Peter McMurray and James Usher. I'm Florence Sperling.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.